Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with Usha Srinivasan and Priya Das about Folk C, the Silicon Valley Folk Festival, this Saturday in San Jose. I'll also talk with Noah Cohen, Executive Director of the San Francisco International Film Festival, which runs from April 4th to the 17th at venues across the Bay Area. This year's edition of the festival includes honors for Wayne Wang, Rob Epstein, Jerry Friedman, and a special tribute to Charlize Theron at the Castro Theater on April 8th. You'll learn more about that. From TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, we'll meet with Executive Director Phil Santora about their latest production, the musical The Bridges of Madison County. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, reviews the book Something Wonderful by Todd Purdom about the collaboration between composer Richard Rodgers and his longtime lyricist, dramatist Oscar Hammerstein. All ahead on Open Air. Stay with us. The hits keep coming to TheaterWorks Silicon Valley as they are about to open the soaring musical romance The Bridges of Madison County, winner of the 2014 Tony Award for Best Musical. It'll run April 4th to the 29th at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. It's based on the 1992 best-selling novel by Robert James Waller about love both lost and found, set amidst the cornfields of Iowa in 1965. Here to join me in studio is the executive director of the TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, Phil Santora. Phil has been with TheaterWorks since 2007, and prior work in administrative in the arts in Chicago, Atlanta, Cleveland, and New Brunswick. He holds an MFA in theater administration from the prestigious Yale School of Drama and a BA in drama from Duke University. Phil, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
Of course. I'm not as familiar with The Bridges of Madison County as other more standard musicals. Tell us how this came to be a part of your season. Give us an insight into the process.
Sure. The season selection process involves us reading plays, seeing plays. The way this one began is I was in New York, and the show was in Broadway previews. It hadn't even opened yet. And a friend of mine recommended we go see it because of the music. Jason Robert Brown, who composed the score, he wrote Parade. He wrote The Last 5 Years, which was at ACT.
Tony Award winner for 1999, Award. Parade.
Yep. Had composed the score to this. And Marcia Norman, who wrote the book for The Secret Garden, Tony Award winner for Night Mother, had written the book. And I went in, honestly, a little bit not sure I wanted to see it. I'm not really a romance novel kind of guy. And I have to say that within about 20 minutes, I was leaning forward on the edge of my chair thinking, we have to put this show on our stage. They took a story that has some sentimentality to it and hired two people who would find the truth in it. And so the music, the book, the lyrics take you on a very honest, real story. And it is some of the most glorious music I have ever heard in a theater. It's amazing.
And some great street cred from Jason Robert Brown in that. Give us, you know, this was based on a phenomenal selling novel back in 1992, I guess it was The Bridges of Madison County. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the synopsis and how it compacts into a musical.
The book, the musical, and the movie follow the journey of an Italian-Irish immigrant woman named Francesca, who at the end of World War II falls in love with and marries an American soldier named Bud. And he relocates her from Italy to the cornfields of Middle America, where she gets married, raises children, and lives on a farm. One weekend, Bud takes the kids off to a state fair, and a photographer for National Geographic named Rob comes wandering through town to photograph the bridges of Madison County. They meet. There's an immediate spark. and something very special happens between them. And the play follows the emotional journey they go on, and at the end, the decisions Francesca has to make about what is most important in her life and what is she prepared to give up for that. Is that feeling she has for Robert or her feeling for her family and her children where ultimately she's going to take her life? And what I love about the musical is there's an epilogue sequence where you follow her life for the decades after this weekend where the play takes place and see all the things that happened because of the choices she made.
This requires two very strong artists in the main roles, which you have in Joan Hess as Francesca and Rob Richardson as the photographer, both making their theater work Silicon Valley debuts in these roles, but with a lot of street cred in their resumes. Joan Hess has performed on Broadway in many productions, including Mamma Mia, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Bells Are Ringing, Kiss Me, Kate, and Crazy for You. Very versatile actress, toured nationally in several shows, and was featured in the PBS Great Performances in My Favorite Broadway, which was hosted by Julie Andrews. And then with Rob Richardson, also a Broadway vet, including the 2013 revival of Jekyll and Hyde, A Tale of Two Cities, many off-Broadway productions, and also a national touring veteran. That's quite a start to your cast.
Yes, we have a real strong commitment to bringing the best Bay Area talent together with really amazing talent from across the country. Bridges of Madison County is no exception. Three of the actors are from New York. Another two are currently living in New York, but actually from the Bay Area. They've worked with us for years before they went to New York to take their career to another level. So you'll find people like Rob and Joan on the main stage with some amazing local singers to tell the story as a group.
Mm-hmm. And the rest of the cast, tell us about them.
Well, we have Courtney Stokes. It's a large cast.
Well, we don't have to lose everyone.
We don't have to lose everyone. Courtney Stokes, who actually started out with us many years ago when we did the world premiere of Andrew Lippert's The Little Princess. She started as a child actress with us.
Well, let's back up a minute. Why is it such a big cast when it seems like such an intimate romantic story between three people, or at least four or five at the most?
Well, as I said, I think what's interesting about this play is that it's not just about the relationship between the two of them, or even the triangle between Rob, her husband Bud, and Francesca. It's about the implications of your life on the people around you and the choices you make. So, for example, her children are characters in it. Her neighbors are characters in it. Actually, Bud's ex-wife appears as a character in one flashback sequence. Francesca's family in Italy appears in a sequence. So you see how the choices you make aren't just your choices, but they're like a pebble in a pond and
right.
They ripple out.
Right, right. Interesting. Now, in this day and age, I've seen it all over in the operatic world and the Broadway world. There's a great opportunity to use projection. Mm-hmm. And creative visuals. What are we going to see on the stage of TheaterWorks Silicon Valley for this?
This show actually is, the production concept for it is pretty simple. We've done projections, we've done all that sort of stuff, but this show is really about the actors telling you the story. It's such a human personal story. They move chairs, they tell the story, and create the world for you. It's that sort of timeless storytelling of people telling us things live, something that only theater can do.
Mm-hmm. And this is going to be directed by TheaterWorks Silicon Valley artistic director Robert Kelly, who's been a previous guest on Open Air several times. What's Robert's special mojo for this show?
Yeah, that was the other thing. I leaned forward and said, we have to do this when I saw it in New York. And my second thought was, and we have to do this because it's such a Kelly show.
All right.
Kelly has this amazing opportunity to find the heart and the honesty in a piece of theater. And his ability to tell this story with respect for the characters and truth is what will keep it emotional, romantic, real, and yet not kind of tipping into the sentimental, which is the danger with a piece like this.
Sure.
Kelly will keep it honest, mm-hmm. and that's what makes it work.
Nice. This runs through the 29th of April, opens on April 4th at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. Anything else you want to share about the production in particular?
No, we had our first rehearsal with the orchestra last week, and the score is unbelievable, so much so that our first violinist played the national tour of this show. she's doing another national tour, and she actually asked if she could be excused for a month so she could come do it with us because she missed the music so much.
Wow. That's great. Let's hear some of that fantastic score by James Robert Brown as part of the Bridges of Madison County. Phil Santora, thanks for stopping by. I understand you have a view of the school here not far from your home, so it wasn't too much of a schlep for you to come in.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Phil Santora, TheaterWorks Silicon Valley Executive Director. Do catch the Bridges of Madison County at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts on Castro Street in Mountain View, the 4th of April through the 29th. Information at theaterworks.org.
Starts to blow, and then what do you know? Something's different, I can't quite explain. Like a sound in the back of my brain, but undefined. A shift in the light, or the sun just got brighter. For sure there's a change in the air. It's like something I wasn't aware. Expected. No, he looked at me like he really could see. Quietly, but the stranger and I, we connected. When he looked at me, what on earth could that be?
She stood in this spot. Has she tasted this water? Has she walked on that bridge with her hair blowing in this breeze? I am looking for the light. I am looking for the light. I am looking for.
From the original Broadway production, in this recording, you heard Stephen Pasquale as Rob and Kelly O'Hara as Francesca, the lead. You'll hear it's TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. In those roles, Rob Richardson as the photographer and Joan Hess as Francesca. Information for this very fulfilling, full-bodied musical at theaterworks.org, presented by TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. Well, all sorts of music from around the globe will be available for your ears this Saturday at the Silicon Valley Folk Festival at the Mexican Heritage Plaza in San Jose at 2 and 6 p.m. Music from Mexico, Brazil, as well as dance from India, China, Philippines, Scotland, Nigeria, and Congo represented. I've got two of the organizers joining me in studio to talk about this very special event on Saturday. Usha Srinivasan is a trained classical Indian dancer and founded Sangam Arts in 2013 and is its current president. Her passion for advocacy of the arts has earned her several honorary appointments, including cultural commissioner for the city of Santa Clara. She's a board member for the San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival and Knight Foundation's Creative Community Fellow. She is also a high-tech executive with over 20 years' experience in product management, marketing, and business development. Welcome back to our open airwaves.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Priya Das is creative director at Sangam, also an arts critic and columnist focused on the South Asian community. She is a trained Indian dancer as well. Priya is a project manager at a Silicon Valley startup. Welcome to you, Priya.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
Of course. Well, this Saturday's concerts are a joint presentation of Mosaic Silicon Valley and Expression Dances of India. You are co-founders of Mosaic Silicon Valley. an initiative that aims to strengthen this diversified community that we have now down in Silicon Valley. Tell us a little bit about the hunger for arts down there now with this global community converging on Silicon Valley.
Yeah, as you know, David, over the past 30 years, we've seen kind of tremendous changes in demographics in Silicon Valley, overall in the U.S., but more particularly in Silicon Valley, with no particular race or ethnic group making up more than a third of our population. And what makes this wave of immigrants different from previous waves of immigrants is that they come from Latin America and Asia. They don't necessarily come here fleeing persecution or war. They have constant interactions with their homeland. And many people like Priya and I, you know, we are quite proud of where we come from and we embrace our new American homeland, but we are eager to kind of retain those aspects of our identity that make us who we are. And we are not alone in that. So almost every community out there has its own rich heritage and art forms that they would like to practice. But what we found is there's a lot of wonderful arts that are practiced, created, presented, but it's happening in cultural silos. So what we are hoping to do is to get people to kind of realize all the beautiful, rich diversity that surrounds us, because it's a wasted opportunity. It's like going to Venice and staying in your hotel room if all you do is just appreciate your own art forms.
And then with all of these various ethnic communities, instead of a ghettoization, we do want that sharing aspect of things to come out.
Absolutely. And the reason we chose Mosaic was, you know, the notion of America as a melting pot, the whole kind of social integration model that we've had doesn't quite hold because we have the second wave of immigrants that could shed every bit of their identity and still look different. And so that's where the metaphor of the mosaic, I think, is more appropriate. And that's why we founded Mosaic Silicon Valley. Mm.
Well, it's such an interesting place right now because there's not only a huge influx of people staying and working down there, but also now starting to form communities down there. So
yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Priya, tell us a little bit about how these particular groups were included in the festival.
So like with any mosaic event, we look for specifically for high-quality production companies, be it music, be it dance, be it any other kind of performing or other arts. So we start with quality, and then we also start with intent. How motivated are they to be a fabric of the current community within Silicon Valley? Are they happy to be just within their cultural silo? Do they want to even build a bridge? So those are the two criteria we use. And then we actually go and have conversations with them based on what they want to present. We don't impose, you know, an artificial barrier in terms of, you know, we don't say go make, you know, commission a special work for us. So we say, what is the best in your culture that celebrates your spirit and your, you know, the natural spirit of that community, and bring that out. And so then what I do as creative director is I work with all these groups, come back with concepts, and see what is common. And it's so amazing that I don't even have to work very hard. You know, I have the most amazing job in the world. I get to meet these wonderful artists. I get to work with wonderful concepts. And then I come back home, and then I just put it all together, right? It sounds simple. Obviously, it's not that simple. But you'll see, for example, we have, in the course of my journey, we noticed that there are dances we all know is an expression of joy and celebration, but dances are also used as a way to keep armies fighting fit way back when. Mm. And that was something that I knew existed in India in one particular folk tradition called Dandiya Ras. They use sticks in place of swords. But when I met the Red Thistle Company...
Much safer that way on the
baseline. So the Red Thistle Company, when I met with them, they present Scottish and Highland dancing, and I started talking to them. And then in my research, I found out that Highland dancing also has the same theme. So we actually have music here, which is called the Old Lilt, from the Scottish and Highland dancing. And then the other one called Ras, which is from the martial art folk tradition of India.
Let's take a little trip to Scotland first and then more with Usha and Priya.
Thank you.
representing Scotland, Red Thistle, at the first ever Silicon Valley Folk Dance Festival this coming Saturday. Performances at 2 and 6. I'm talking with Usha Srinivasan and Priya Das about this Saturday's very special focus on international performers, some 12 traditions, 9 different countries represented, and I understand a combination of live and recorded music as well as a lot of live percussion.
That's correct, yeah. And we've actually had an opportunity to work with Akoma Arts, which is a West African kind of percussive ensemble, also a Brazilian drumming circle that is based in San Jose, and I'm forgetting the Indian Dhol, the Punjabi Dhol. And it's really beautiful. I think the whole purpose of Folksy is, in addition to showcasing uplifting art, is to kind of help highlight the things that bind us. Because even though on the surface, you know, Indian and Scottish dancers could, you know, look very dissimilar, again, there's many things when you just peel back just the surface, you'll see we have things in common. And so I think that nothing drives home that point like the percussion, the drums, when they come together and they play, and it's just something to behold.
Mm. I love the opportunity to say that Hawaii is being represented by, let me try this, Halau Napuao Kamakihanaoha.
There you go. Napua.
Not bad.
It's Napua Oka Moki Hanaua. Yeah. Okay. There you go. It's like the blind leading the blind a bit, but that's okay. I think our Kumuluana will forgive us for that.
She got the plug anyway.
Yeah. They're wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. Also represented this coming Saturday. Let's hear, go out with some music called Bloom Water Lily. It's a beautiful selection. What is that? Give us the context of how that will be presented.
So that is part of our an act that we are calling Cultural Spotlight, and that actually and celebration. So Blooming Water Lilies is by the Achieve Dance Arts Academy, and it talks about people's appreciation for nature and very simply how they enjoy and make the life that they love. So we have, you know, so in that segment we also have what we're calling the celebration segment. We also have other acts such as Parangal, which is a Filipino arts company that talks about wedding traditions, wedding celebrations, celebrations of the harvest from the floodplains of Philippines. So that is the context for the Blooming Water Lilies celebration.
Yeah, and these beautiful Chinese dancers are just exquisite.
Well, that's the music we're hearing now. We are giving away 5 pairs of tickets for this Saturday for folks that call us right now at 415-841-4134. Operators are standing by. Actually, my producer, Niels Swinkels, will be answering the phone, offering you these tickets to the first ever Folksy Silicon Valley Folk Festival happening at the
Mexican Heritage Plaza
down in downtown San Jose this coming Saturday at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. Usha Srinivasan and Priya Das, Mazel tov, toy, 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 whatever international word you want to use for
thank
offering you.
You
congratulations for this Saturday. I'm sure it's going to be a very special event.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
415-841-4134 if you'd like some tickets for this Saturday's presentation at either 2 or 6 p.m. Again, it's going to be at the Mexican Heritage Plaza in San Jose. For information about everyone that's performing, go to tinyurl.com/FolkSI, Folksy 2018. Again, tickets 415-841-4134. The 2018 San Francisco International Film Festival gets underway next Wednesday, and for the next couple of weeks, close to 200 films will be screened, including 57 narrative features, 37 documentary features, some 83 shorts, and 45 countries represented, and 46 languages, among many other numbers that we'll be discussing with my guest, the executive director of the festival, Noah Cohen. Noah, thanks for coming in tonight. I mean, this is during what must be the very busy final week before the festival leading up to opening night, although I'll bet you a lot of the hard work has already been done.
Yeah, the programming season really begins in fall and kind of reaches a crescendo around the Sundance Film Festival in January. We're both a film festival and big film presenter all year long here in San Francisco, but also a major supporter of independent films, not just from the Bay Area, but around the country. So many of the films we've helped out end up premiering in Sundance, and then the ones that don't end up starting in San Francisco. So it's an important time for our filmmakers and for us.
And of course, you want to make everyone feel at home, those that are attending the festival, so there's a lot of arrangements to be made for the filmmakers and their entourages, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Everyone from big movie stars to filmmakers from Central Asia all have their own specific needs.
Well, tell me a little bit about how the Me Too and the Time's Up movements have affected your programming, not only for this year, but looking into future festivals.
Well, in some ways, I feel as though we've been sort of looking at these issues for some time. You know, gender balance in film is something that's been talked about at film festivals. Many have committed to it. We're very close this year, and we're particularly close in our world premieres and our competitions. And in fact, I think in our launch program, which is actually the kind of mechanism by which we put new filmmakers into the distribution system, we actually have majority representation by women. On top of that, I think that we also as an organization just look to what film festivals can do to not just prevent some of the terrible things we've been reading about and hearing about happening in film, but actually facilitate discussion and you know, create new structures that will actually benefit women artists moving forward. We do this kind of in a combination between our sort of granting programs and residency programs, as well as the presentation of films made by women.
What are some of the standouts for this year's festival of women creators?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the two, probably among the two best directed films we're showing in the festival are one by Chloe Zhao, who was born in China, raised in the U.S., called The Writer, which is going to be coming out actually in May. Just set on a reservation in North Dakota, using amateur actors, but in this incredibly beautiful movie about the West and its mythologies told through these kind of old rodeo cowboys. And when they get old, around 30. So they're not that old, but it's funny. Their careers have a short span, especially up there. And then Deborah Granick, who discovered Jennifer Lawrence with Winterbone, her first film, has sort of done it again. With this quite extraordinary young actress called Thomasin McKenzie in this beautiful film called Leave No Trace, which actually I think will resonate with a lot of people in Northern California because it concerns a father and daughter who really want to live off the grid. And they're sort of brought in by the authorities at one point. And it's interesting watching this teenage girl suddenly realize that there's this larger world of social interactions and watch her kind of grow up while her father still really wants that lifestyle that they've been able to enjoy their whole lives. So two very beautiful films directed by women. I think these two films are going to be among the best directed of the year.
Well, the opening night film is an important decision, kind of setting the mood for the festival. Tell us about next Wednesday's opening offering, A Kid Like Jake, that'll be at the Castro Theater.
We're incredibly proud of this film. In some ways, it's a bit of a throwback to those amazing, intense social dramas of the sort of 60s and 70s that were dealing with the issues of the day. It's the first film produced by Jim Parsons, who is better known as Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory. He's a very different role here. He plays the father, with Claire Danes being the mother, of a young son about to enter kindergarten, who begins showing signs of non-gender binary behavior. And between his principal and their friends, everyone is offering advice and trying to lead them either to just say this is a phase, or lead them to labeling their child as a trans person. And the conversations that they have feel very much like the conversations that parents all over the country are happening, as the sort of the new emergence, the reality of the trans movement in this country starts to become so rich. What makes this film, I think, all the more kind of emotionally present is that the filmmaker himself, Silas Howard, is a trans man, and was very involved in the making of the Transparent television show as well as This Is Us. And so there's a real emotional resonance here, a beautiful ensemble cast. It also includes Octavia Spencer and Priyanka Chopra. And I think really looks at multiple sides of this kind of really fascinating new social development in our society. And just watching it through the lens of these beautiful actresses and amazing director makes it something very special and something that felt very important for us for the opening.
And how perfect to have it at the Castro Theater in the Castro.
Amazing to have it at the Castro. In fact, I mean, the representation in our big nights this year, I'm very, very proud of. I mean, it feels like a real reflection of what we like to call Bay Area values, for the kind of artists that need to be championed, the kind of storytelling that really matters. Our centerpiece is kind of the creation out of the mind of one of the sort of the great figures of sort of Bay Area music culture, Boots Riley, you know, among the most kind of interesting artists, period, but certainly a leader in sort of the kind of the new variations on African-American music here in the Bay Area. And his film, Sorry to Bother You, is an amazing, kind of beautiful, odd, psychedelic tribute to Oakland that's already basically sold out the Castro and the Grand Lake, where we're showing the movie on both nights. And then closing night is pretty interesting, too. Gus Van Sant is a very well-known filmmaker, made films like Milk and Good Will Hunting. He's made this quite iconoclastic portrait of this sort of irreverent Portland cartoonist, John Callahan. You know, Joaquin Phoenix plays him. Most of the movie, he's in a wheelchair, but he has a very full life. I mean, he has this incredible romantic relationship with a woman who begins as a physical therapist and goes into multiple professions and kind of reengages with him. It's played by Rooney Mara and is beautiful. But the center of the film is this beautiful relationship that he has with his. I mean, this doesn't sound like much fun at all. The film is such a huge, wonderful comedy in so many ways, with his AA coach, as he's sort of, you know, recovering, as he's a recovering alcoholic. And what they kind of learn is through humor and through being an entertaining cynicism towards the society around them. These two men really form an incredible bond of friendship, and it's Jonah Hill is the quite flamboyant AA. Captain, and the two of them are just magnificent together. That's also at the Castro.
Closing night film on the 15th. Don't worry, he won't get far on foot. Gus Van Sant's film.
Don't worry, he won't get far on foot, I think, sums up the kind of humor of the movie. Very irreverent piece.
Well, we're playing sandwich here. We've talked about the opening, the closing. What's in the middle, the centerpiece for a program where satire is front and center?
Exactly. I did mention it a minute ago. It's Boots Riley and the Sorry to Bother You.
Oh, Sorry to Bother You. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the tributes that are going on. One to the chameleon-like Charlize Theron, and a screening of her new film.
Yeah, we're really happy about our tributes this year. It really goes from these major movie stars like Charlize Theron, and I think there's only a couple of tickets left on that one. People were fascinated by kind of listening to her and how that kind of ferocity that you see in films like Mad Max and Atomic Blonde comes to be. We're also showing a really beautiful film, a new film called Tully, that puts her back together with writer Diablo Cody and director Jason Reitman. They made Young Adult together. This film is a very different tone. It's sort of about motherhood and the kind of the fantasy life that we develop for ourselves when we actually are feeling a little overburdened. And it has there's a beautiful kind of lyrical quality to it, and she is just marvelous as this mother who's just kind of had enough.
Mm. Also a tribute to Wayne Wang.
Yeah, I mean, we have two kind of amazing local icons in our tributes this year. Well, I guess three, although one is a pair. Wayne Wang on one side. Basically, before him, there was, there were Asian Americans in film, the idea of an Asian American auteur filmmaker, kind of a major director, was not known. And with Chan Is Missing almost 30 years ago, he actually just changed the entire script about who gets to be a director and who gets to be supported as a director, and has since become kind of world famous in many ways, has changed Hollywood as well as changing the independent scene through his many, many films, including probably his most famous collaboration with Amy Tan on Joy Luck Club. Now's the time. He's been actually spending the last 5 years remastering and kind of tinkering with his movies to kind of update them for today, and we're looking forward to showing Smoke, probably his most beloved movie with Harvey Keitel back from about 15 years ago. We're also delighted to have the opportunity to tribute Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman. I mean, these are true heroes of the documentary world, of the LGBTQ world, and just great mentors here in San Francisco. They've been here for 30 years. Rob's won 2 Oscars, one of them with Jeffrey for Tales from the Quilt. Common Threads, Tales from the Quilt. Beautiful, beautiful documentary about the first 10 years of the AIDS crisis. And, of course, Rob's first major feature and landmark was The Times of Harvey Milk, a film very dear to us here in San Francisco.
Indeed. Science, space, and technology takes an important role in this festival. I have to confess a bit of ignorance here. Has this always been a part of the San Francisco Film Festival, or is this something that's the result of the partnership with the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation?
Every year we identify a few little themes that we found running through. Basically, the programmers, there's 5 of us, and we just kind of travel around the world and watch a ton of links that are sent to us.
Oh, you poor people. You poor people.
I know, it's the worst job in the entire world. and eventually we come to a big list, and we start looking at it and start seeing where there's connections, where there's opportunities to actually talk about things. And this year, it really fell into place that we were talking about space. And several films kind of identified that. We always do have a number of films that deal with science and technology, both because they're topics that people in the Bay Area really respond to, but also because we have this sort of larger partnership with the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, a major funder of science here in the United States. And we work with them on many levels. We help fund films about science. We do a big presentation of a kind of Oscar-y movie in the fall, like Hidden Figures here, with a bunch of scientists and educators to move them forward. But this year, the space program is just great. The Mercury 13 film in particular, I'd recommend to any audience. This is one of those stand-up-and-shout to the rooftops documentaries about the women who trained alongside the guys in the 1960s prepare for space travel. And then, just for reasons of pure sexism, the women got cut out of the program. The guys got to go to the moon. And the women actually did better at the tests than the guys did. So later on, when
Hidden Figures,
yeah, exactly, it's the same story all over again. Yeah. What's great is a lot of those women, justifiably a little pissed off, you know, in the film, actually went on to do amazing things. Many of them began women's rights organizations. National Organization of Women, in particular, was helped to be founded by 2 of those women, and almost all of them are still alive. And they're these wonderful kind of characters. You know, if you can imagine, these women were actually taken from, these speed demon crop dusters from the countryside, right? So if they could fly a plane really fast, they could go and train for space. So that same spirit is alive and well in these sort of women in their 70s and 80s. So they're just a hoot. And we're expecting a couple of them to come and join us, as well as a couple of younger women who have been able to go through the process at NASA in a much kinder time.
Fantastic. Mercury 13 will be screened on Sunday, April 8th at SF MoMA and Tuesday, April 10th at the Roxy. Now, I'm assuming no collusion is involved with the presentation of Salyut 7, a 2017 Russian film.
This is just a hoot. We like to keep things in balance here. And so we'll have this amazing story about
as long as it's not fair and balanced.
There you go. Exactly. But we actually just happened upon this quite extraordinary film. It won all the big awards at the Russian Film Awards last year, and it's kind of like the Gravity of Russia. It sort of tells the story of these astronauts trying to get out when the space station Mir is collapsing. And it's a great old-fashioned thriller, but it also sort of shows the fissures in politics that the astronauts have to contend with, as all astronauts do here as well, elsewhere, China. Does so in this way that's sometimes subtle, sometimes not, but I think really resonates. And if you actually watch the two films together, I think you definitely feel a kind of camaraderie between the two programs and the astronauts who are in them.
Salyut 7, winner of the Best Film at the Golden Eagle Awards, which is Russia's equivalent to the Oscars, will be screened this coming Sunday, April 8th at 4 o'clock at the Castro Theater. Some great space films involved in this year's festival. I also noticed that seems to be a small emphasis on some classics also a part of the festival. What was the inspiration for including the 1942 To Be or Not to Be, the wonderful film with Jack Benny and Carol Lombard?
We always have a commitment at this festival to show a lot of classics, and often they're prompted by some of our honorees. And in this case, we're tributing the sort of famous film writer and academic Annette Insdorf. She's taught all over the country, published dozens and dozens of books, a real leader in the field. And she's best known for her books about East European filmmaker Krzysztof Kieślowski. And so we just assumed she was going to show one of those movies. She turned around and said, no, I want to show one of my favorites. And so Jack Benny and To Be or Not to Be with... It's a magnificent cast and great wit will actually be on the our screens.
Incredible direction of Ernst Lubitsch, too. It's amazing. That'll be screened on Saturday, April 14th at 1 in the afternoon at SF MoMA. Just a couple moments to talk about some great live music that's a part of the film festival this year, including music by Blonde Redhead, Mark Capel's Red Room Orchestra, very innovative group, and of course our own beloved Kronos Quartet.
Yeah, there's been a commitment for a decade or more to doing really innovative music and film combinations. This year is no different. Kind of in order, the Mark Capel, which is the sort of first night. We go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. It's good, very orderly. And the Mark Capel is the first one on Monday. This is a tribute to Oddball Films, this quite extraordinary collection of sort of films and tidbits and advertising and kind of what have you, that was taken from the collection of Stephen Parr, who created this quite extraordinary library in Oddball Films and unfortunately passed away over the last year. And we will be Mark has really created this incredible soundscape, an amazing group of amazing music that really goes everywhere from sort of klezmer to ABBA and back again, to actually delight in these like wonderful short films that are the core of Oddball's Oddball collection.
And we're going to go out with some music of the Kronos Quartet. Tell us about their
absolutely. This is maybe one of the great events of the year for lovers of both film and music. Sam Green, who was Bay Area regular for a long time, lives in New York now. But Sam approached the Kronos Quartet and said, I want to do a live documentary with you. And that means essentially you create a documentary, which they did about the band using lots of archival footage. Whenever the film is shown, it's live narrated by Sam and then live orchestrated by Kronos. And that's precisely what we're going to be doing at the Castro Theater. So you're going to have some movie, and then Sam will do a little live narration and then interact with the quartet, who will then play some of their greatest hits on stage to kind of create color, to create atmosphere around the screening. This has played once before, and virtually everyone in the room said it was among their most memorable experiences with film. So I really encourage people to seek this one out.
Tuesday, April 10th at 7, the Kronos Quartet with Sam Green, A Thousand Thoughts, a live documentary, plus other great live music events with Blonde Redhead and Mark Capel's Red Room Orchestra. So much to do, don't even think about leaving town between April 4th and April 17th to catch some of the close to 200 films for this year's 2018 San Francisco International Film Festival, the 61st such incarnation. Talking with Noah Cowan, the executive director. Thanks so much for coming in, Noah.
My pleasure.
More information about all of these films in the comprehensive site sffilm.org. Music of the Kronos Quartet here to go out. And we have some tickets to give away for the Saturday, April 7th, 5:30 screening at the Castro Theater. The film is called Searching, is directed by Arish Shaganti, expected to attend. It's a nail-biter, a fresh and innovative film told exclusively through computer screens. 16-year-old Margot can't quite connect emotionally with her dad, David, who is played by a very charismatic John Cho, who has been withdrawn and overprotective since her mother passed away. This film is, again, two pairs of complimentary tickets for next Saturday, the 7th, at 5:30 for folks that call 415-841-4134. By the way, a full hour of information about the San Francisco International Film Festival will be this coming Monday as part of City Visions, Monday at 7 o'clock. Tune in for more information. But for a couple of pairs of tickets for this film, Searching, on the 7th at 5:30 at the Castro Theater, 415-841-4134.
shore where the wind comes sweeping down the plain. And the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain. Oklahoma, every night my honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. We know we belong to the land, and the land we belong to is grand. And when we say,
yo!
I-if-I-O-E-A, we're only saying you're doing fine, Oklahoma, Oklahoma, okay.
Incredible music of Rodgers and Hammerstein to introduce this next segment with our regular contributor, Peter Robinson, to talk about the book Something Wonderful by Todd Purdom and that incredible collaborative team. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And indeed, that was Oklahoma. And I think March the 31st is an important date. It's 75 years since Rodgers and Hammerstein teamed up together. And, of course, the first great musical onstage success was Oklahoma. They'd each written different scores before separately, but this is what really brought them together at the beginning of really writing dozens of Broadway shows. It was the apex of the great age of songwriting. They were the creators of classic Broadway musicals. And in terms of song and dance numbers, they brought both drama and character to the stage. And, of course, these would then turn into movies, and some of the individual songs would continue as popular musical items on radio throughout not only their lifetime, but down to today. So what Todd Purdom has done in his book, Something Wonderful, published by Holt, is give us a study of first how they worked together, even though they were very different personalities and emotionally sometimes distant from each other, and how the combination of the words or the lyrics by Hammerstein were then put together by the music from Richard Rodgers. And today, we think of the American Songbook as some classic relic of the past, but I did do some checking, and in 2014, if you took all their particular productions, Oklahoma, Carousel, South Pacific, The King and I, and The Sound of Music, these have been reproduced not only on Broadway and on the London stage, but also in schools as ways of teaching how the classic American musical comes together. And of course, local companies here in Marin, at the Mountain Play, several of their particular productions, including Oklahoma, have been done in recent years. So this got me round to thinking about how strange for someone who gave us essentially the American Songbook, how strange in 1952 Oscar Hammerstein suddenly ran into problems with the House on the Un-American Activities under McCarthy. He applied for his passport to be extended. They said, we can extend it for a couple of months, but we're not sure about you. And, of course, I think it gave me, from a historian's point of view, a real understanding of what being investigated for being a communist, when really only some of his friends have been part of the Screenwriters Guild, which were, in fact, getting, and the bright word is persecuted, for a man who put the lyrics, put the words down to essentially the American Songbook. So we know Purdom really as a political writer. He writes for Politico. His previous books have been studies on contemporary politics over the years. So this is a departure in terms of biography, in terms of really understanding a musical memoir and how the creative process works from essentially two very different type of people. So As a contrast to Oklahoma, which is very much a song, as the title suggests, about the homeland, about America in the 1940s, 1950s, they would go on to deal with South Pacific, which again takes us in different ways to the Second World War. And then a classic, which is still memorable today, The King and I. And that, of course, was with Yul Brynner. Incidentally, in Thailand, where the king is treated literally as a god, the musical caused a great deal of concern. And I was thinking just a couple of months back, when the king of Thailand did die, how once again that sense of deification, the worship of the king, really played a part. Now, in this particular sequence, which we're going to be listening to, it is the famous sequence when the English teacher is inviting the king to dance. So suddenly you've got the people, different classes, different parts of the empire, different countries, different cultures coming together, and the invitation, shall we dance? And here it comes.
Introduced, I do not know you well, but when the music started, something drew me to your side. So many men and girls are in each other's arms, it made me think we might be similarly occupied. Shall we dance? On a bright cloud of music, shall we fly? Shall we dance? Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye? Or perchance, when the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance? On a clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen, shall we dance? Shall we dance? Shall we dance?
So there you have it, the invitation to dance. And I think it's one of those turning points in a musical where the story can hinge both on the words and on the action, an invitation for the king to step up to it. Now, the king is well educated, and he knows that this is not how normal English lords dance. In fact, the dance they're doing is a polka, and you can listen to the bum, bum, bum coming in as they rotate around the dance floor. Now, I've chosen that particular piece because it does bring together the importance of lyrics and the importance of music and the importance of pacing, the importance of timing, and also it's a moment of transformation, because suddenly Yul Brynner, who is rather stiff, reserved, standing back, is now loosened up by the rhythms of the music. And that really speaks to me about how the team, Rodgers and Hammerstein, really came together. And as you watch this, either on the movie version or on the original one with Gertrude Stein playing the actual role of the English teacher, you are mesmerised. You're mesmerised. You're drawn into the story. And I think that is part of their gift as composers, as songwriters. So even though at times the song seemed dated, the period seems historic, you could almost say anachronistic, in fact, it has been repeated. And one of the fears that Rodgers had, which is Rodgers the musician who died in 1976, is that he wondered, would his musicals continue? And this was the area when the Rocky Horror Show was about to come in, and you've got a whole different phase of how things are happening. And, of course, he was wrong. He died, but then in the 1990s, we had a huge revival, both on the London stage and on Broadway, and here in the 21st century, we're still humming these wonderful numbers.
Peter, I feel I do need to make an editorial comment before the phone calls come in. It was not Gertrude Stein that starred in it. It was Gertrude Lawrence.
Gertrude Lawrence. Okay.
Very, very different.
A slip of the lip can sink the ship, but now we've been put back on the page again. It was Gertrude Lawrence. It was indeed. They both were.
Although that would be a fascinating musical revival.
They could dance it out at Shakespeare and Company's bookstore in Paris.
Yeah, exactly.
Correction stood. Thank you, sir. So I'm going to finish with one final number, which shows you how a song can move from being a musical format to becoming almost part of folk legend. And the story behind You Never Walk Alone, which really came from Carousel, ended up at my hometown, Liverpool. Liverpool in England, let's get a plug in for Liverpool Football Club. And they would merrily break into this happy Rodgers and Hammerstein number with no reference whatsoever to Carousel, although things kept on going around. So one more time, the name of the book, Something Wonderful, the author, Tob Purdom, and it is a great understanding of how the American Songbook not only came to be, but came to continue. And I would highly recommend it for people interested in stage, in television, in adaptations, to see how some of the great lyrics, some of the great songwritings of the 20th century are still alive and living on the stage today.
You'll never walk alone with that book, Peter. Thank you very much for that review.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
Liverpool, You'll Never Walk Alone, indeed. That's Open Air for this Thursday, the last open air of the month of March. I'm David Latulip. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for helping produce the show. A reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. If you've got a show segment suggestion, by all means, send me that suggestion. My email is david@kalw.org. Thanks again for listening. And thanks again to Rose Aguilar for so graciously hosting Open Air last week in my absence. Thanks again, Rose.